I'm Sarah.
Hey, I'm Trish.
This is our podcast, Trying to Win, where we talk about being trial lawyers, female lawyers, and...
People. We're doing people this week. We're doing well-being, lawyer well-being. So we've got a format that we usually use where we kind of do a trial format, opening statements, talk about where we're going, introduce our guest speaker today, do our witness examination. You're going to get examined today, Heidi. And then sum it up with our closing arguments. And then we ask you for the verdict. And that's where we ask you to review, rate, listen, download, all of those great things.
Yeah. And so because we are in the midst of well-being in the law week, we have asked Heidi Alexander to join us. Heidi is Massachusetts' first director of the Supreme Judicial Court Standing Committee on Lawyer Well-Being, which is a very long title. And before that, she has served in a number of roles. I actually listened to another podcast Heidi was on recently and, you know, has a great story about how she kind of came up and landed where she currently is, including some time as a lawyer and as a law clerk, and has also written a book. And I mean, it's amazing. And so we'd like to introduce Heidi Alexander and jump right into it. So welcome, Heidi, to Trying to Win. We're really super excited to have you here today. Can you start off just kind of giving us a little bit of an idea of what your role is and what your committee works on?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to. And thank you so much for having me on the podcast. This is a lot of fun. I used to host a podcast, but I don't anymore. So I enjoy being a guest on podcasts, and this is a great one. So thank you very much. So you provided some introduction to me and my work. I came to this work as a practicing attorney who sort of went into the lawyer assistance field. And so I've been doing that for a while, helping lawyers in a number of different ways, and pivoted actually in March, about a day before things shut down in Massachusetts, to this new role. Yes. So it was, you know, but I think in terms of the role, so this was the first time that that this committee had hired a full-time staff person. And I'm happy to talk also more about the history of this committee as well. But just in terms of my role, I was hired in March to become this full-time director and of this committee that was focused on the well-being of attorneys in Massachusetts. And what our charge really was at that point was to implement a 150-page report that a steering committee had worked on for the course of a year. And then published this under the late Chief Justice Gantz here in Massachusetts. And we have a committee of a strong committee of 17 members. And I came on in March. And of course, at that time, we had to think about, you know, what really were our priorities in terms of this work? How were we going to implement the recommendations that had been provided? And how were we going to do it remotely? And so it was almost like taking this little, it was like a startup. That's how I looked at it. I looked at it like through a lens of an entrepreneur, you know, let's start this entity up and figure out, you know, how best we can help, because we know that, we knew attorneys were struggling before this, but certainly struggling even more now throughout COVID.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we actually just wrapped up with another guest that we recorded earlier today talking about personality assessments and the importance of knowing and understanding one another when you're working together on a team, and knowing yourself and having a little grace for yourself from time to time with things. You talked a little bit about you kind of came up through the lawyer's assistance program, and it seems like, since we've been practicing, and I'm old, so I've been practicing
She's
now for
me. I just want everybody to know.
27, 28 years, something like that. I'm really old. Even in law school, they talked a little bit back then about the issue of substance abuse in the legal profession. And that was a focus for a period of time. And then we talked about, you know, in the 90s, that kind of made a shift to professionalism, that maybe if we were nicer to each other in litigation, then it wouldn't be such a stressful practice. And now it seems to be kind of more this more global attack on lawyer well-being. Do you find that has kind of been the progression, and how is your committee kind of making that pivot into this new broader definition of lawyer well-being?
It's a great point, and I do think that these issues have been around for a long time. But I do think, you know, there is something about sort of substance use and addiction that was able to kind of take hold, especially, you know, we have an AA community. And I think especially here in Massachusetts, I mean, what initially happened back in the 70s is that we had a group of attorneys who mainly were at law firms and wanted a community of peer support, where they could go and talk about issues related to substance use, but didn't want to run into a client, right? And so they created this community, and that's really what started the lawyer assistance program. That was kind of the genesis of the lawyer assistance program here in Massachusetts. But, you know, as we know, being an attorney and practicing is very stressful in many different ways. And substance use, you know, can be related to, sort of related to genetics, can also be related to stress, right? It's an effect, that may be due to stress. But I think there are lots of issues inherent in the, in our profession. And so, not only issues with mental health and substance use, but like, for example, you know, what we've focused on here in Massachusetts is there's a real issue in terms of finances, right? So we look at financial distress, like among our solo practitioners and of attorneys who are going to law school, right? And coming out with just huge debt, just unbelievable debt. And so you have those folks. You also have people who are doing like public service work, right? And are making barely anything. And so, and then you have, you know, attorneys in firms, right, where you're bound by the billable hour, right, and that's your time, right? You are bound by that time. And so, in terms of the work of our committee in particular, is I think we're really looking at changing sort of organization, culture, and policy to make real progress. I think maybe 10 or so years ago, there was really a focus on individual well-being, and there's still focus on individual well-being, and there needs to be a focus on individual well-being, sort of learning, practicing self-care, implementing mindfulness practices, educating ourselves, figuring out how to manage stress. But I think that's really only half of the equation. The other half, again, is looking to making those big policy changes. And that's what we're focused on in Massachusetts, which is working really closely with legal employers, with bar associations, with law schools, with regulators and other organizations so that we can kind of lead this organizational culture and policy changes that we think are going to have more of a systemic impact and drive change on a much broader scale. So that's sort of where our focus is. But I think there has to be sort of those two pieces of the equation working together. And I think then we can actually make some real progress when it comes to lawyer and legal well-being.
Have you seen any interest or are you actively trying to engage the bench? So for us in particular as litigators, one of the things that causes us the most stress is deadlines and not having much flexibility in those deadlines, particularly if you have a personal issue that's come up that's going to require you to be out for a period of time. I always tell people the story that I was pregnant with my first daughter and trial was coming up and I moved for a continuance of the trial and the lawyer on the other side said no. And literally made me go and appear in front of the judge to ask for the trial to be continued. Now, I would hope, she just turned 23 on Sunday, so I would hope that that would not happen today, but unfortunately, I think my hope would be dashed quite quickly, you know, in speaking with some of the other female trial lawyers that I know. So I'm real interested to know if there's any effort to involve the bench, or that they have actively sought you guys out to participate in some of these conversations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of our focal points as well here, which is sort of civility is a big part of our work. And I think that really relates to how the bench and the bar communicate. And so one of the ways that we are working on that is trying to increase the communication between the bench and the bar, and doing it at more of a systemic level. So working with every single court and through our trial courts and our chief justices to figure out how we can have these regular and ongoing conversations between the bench and the bar. And in addition to that, we've done a lot of work related to the challenges of underrepresented and historically excluded groups from our profession. And so, and I think, you know, part of that being women and especially women who have kids and families, right, are part of that. And so we are really looking at ways to increase inclusivity when it comes to, you know, just like the example that you gave in terms of deadlines and flexibility. And just recently we came out with this report, which we had a number of town halls with our affinity bar associations, which are the bar associations that represent these, you know, historically excluded groups. And we published this report based on their experiences. And one of the first steps that our trial court took was to actually establish a hotline for people to call, and basically with complaints that they had. If they had an experience like what you're talking about, if they had one of those experiences, to actually bring that forth, and that there would actually be a mechanism to deal with that. So I think, you know, part of it is sort of changing some of these policies. I think the other part is creating just more awareness around all of these issues. And that's a huge part of the work that we do, which is creating awareness of well-being in the law. And so that's things like, you know, getting information out to our legal community, whether it be, I mean, we have a website and newsletter and social media and all that, but also having regular communications with all the bar leaders. We have a legal well-being network that we established, which is a way for primarily actually people in firms to share best practices across the board. You know, here are the things we are doing in our firm, and you may want to consider, you know, looking into that as well. And so I think, again, a lot of our focus is increasing the awareness of these issues. And I think once we do that, we can also have people who, you know, may be on the bench, or a clerk who then sort of, you know, stands up for someone, right? They witness something like this happening, and then they can say, you know what, that's not all right. that has this detrimental impact across the board. So I think there's a lot that's related to that, certainly, and it's really important.
Heidi, what can we as individual professionals, as well as owners of a firm, what can we do to help get rid of this stigma that against talking about mental health and being well or certain addiction disorders? What can we do to try to, you know, not make that such a shame thing anymore? It's all built in so much shame, and it shouldn't be. What can we do?
I think that's really important. And I think that probably the most effective way that I've seen this done is by having leaders come out and share their own experiences. if there's, you know, someone at a firm or a, you know, or someone who's a public figure, right, who talks about their own challenges and is authentic in that, you know, that what that says to people is that, hey, it's okay, right? It's okay that, you know, maybe I made this mistake, or, you know, it's okay that, you know, maybe I'm using alcohol in a way I shouldn't, but I have that awareness and I can actually get help. So it's about, you know, talking about, you know, challenges that we've faced and mistakes that we've made and our ability to go out and seek help. You know, for someone to say, like, let's say a partner at a firm to say, look, I went to our lawyer assistance program when I was struggling, when I went through a divorce, right? I went to them and I got help, and, you know, and it was great. And it was really helpful, you know, for someone to say that, and for an associate to then be sitting there saying, oh, I'm having all this anxiety or whatever it might be. You know, I think that can go a long ways. I was on a panel. It was a while ago. It was sort of, must have been maybe six months ago or so, with a number of law school deans, and we were talking about well-being. And there was one story that one of the deans told. She told a story about having this conversation with a student and actually breaking down in tears. And, you know, and she felt like it was this sort of facade that had come down, and her ability to, like, you know, really be authentic and vulnerable, she felt like made a real impact on that student. And so I think, you know, as lawyers, we're trained to kind of put up that facade, right? And so sometimes, especially with well-being, we need to take it down. And I think that's gonna help reduce some of the stigma.
Do you, in, you know, your reading or studying for your role, find that there is a particular difference where female lawyers struggle more than male lawyers?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm laughing because yes, definitely. No question. I mean, we're talking about a profession that is sort of has always been dominated by white men, right?
So, oh, yeah, you know.
That's we are well familiar. We're trying to fix that.
Yeah. So, certainly. I mean, this is where, you know, where it's all gotten started. I mean, part of what we have actually really focused on this past year is thinking about our working parents, which, of course, you know, that task is, you know, primarily felt by women, right? And so when you are home, especially during this pandemic, right, and I have three young kids, by the way, so I know all about this. You know, in March, things are shutting down, and all of a sudden the kids are out of school, and you know, you're an attorney, and you've got clients to deal with. How does that work, right? And so one of the problems that, you know, we're going to see, and we're going to see the impacts of, are, you know, women falling behind, right? Because they had the primary caretaking responsibility, and all of a sudden they're back, they're, you know, they're not up for partner, they're, you know, compensation, yeah. You know, what, you know, they're being evaluated in different ways. So I really think that, and we're really encouraging firms to really think about that, like, how can we make sure that our women are not leaving the profession? And how can we make sure that they are not falling behind? And maybe that's by looking at, you know, billable hours in a different way. That's like taking, you know, different things into consideration when it comes to evaluation and promotion, right? And, you know, as we know, and it sounds like some of you have kids, you know, I hate to say this, but women are so much more efficient, right? Once you have kids, you understand how to be the most efficient
and how to put,
you
know, yourself
possible.
Last. Yeah,
exactly. So, you know, so like we bring a lot. I think the problem has just been that, again, like we're in this profession that is predominantly men. And so I think we have to shift this, you know, the perspective and the way, you know, and the way of thinking. And that's certainly not an easy thing to do, but we can do it incrementally.
And oh my gosh, we could have hours with you,
because I have a question.
I know, just let me just
let me go first.
I mean, literally the number of times that I have this debate with people about what does it mean to be successful in the practice of law, and why we are applying a definition of success across the board that unless you're an equity partner or unless you make X number of dollars or, you know, you're in a big firm, somehow the definition of success for female lawyers keeps coming back to that as the measure. And I would love to see that measuring stick get changed, because I can tell you, first of all, we were both partners in a large law firm before we left 11 years ago and started Lincoln Durr. And I am 100 times, probably more than that, happier. I am making way more money than I would have made there. I am the master of our kingdom, so to speak, in terms of being able to pick the clients we want to work with instead of being told which clients we should or should not work with and the types of cases. And, you know, so I hear what you're saying with respect to women falling behind, and I'm not saying we don't want women to be successful in that setting, but I think there's got to be a definition shift, and I think large law firms are going to have to at some point decide that what it means to be successful there doesn't all have to look the same.
Yeah, I completely agree. And we're starting to have a lot of those conversations with both our private employers and also public agencies in terms of going back to work, because particularly here in Massachusetts, you know, we haven't been in person. And so everyone's been working remotely. And for, you know, especially for women who are working parents, that can actually be quite helpful, right? Having that, right, that flexibility. And there's definitely a concern about, you know, going back to work and what's that going to mean? And are we just going back to, you know, quote unquote normal, right? And is that the 9 to 5 and I'm not going to be able to have this flexibility so I can do what I need to do? And so we really feel like, you know, this is a moment where we can start to try to change some of those firm policies for the better, particularly as they impact women and particularly moms as well.
My turn.
Okay, go.
Okay, thank you.
Go.
So this is a question I've got, and it's a hypothetical, really. Let's say that I'm a white male, and I'm working at a large law firm, and I bill 2,200 hours in a year. I have a stay-at-home mom wife who does everything for me, including take my clothes to the dry cleaner, blah, blah, blah. And they're bringing in new clients and all this money, et cetera. Let's say the person B is a single mom with 4 kids. Maybe she's a widow, and she's got sole responsibility for all of the children, and she's billing 1,100 hours in a year and barely able to keep up. How does management address the question of pay equity and wanting to retain somebody? Because at some level, and maybe this is just the definition of normal that's a problem, but at some level you wonder, is it fair for one person to be bringing all this stuff to the plate and the other one not, while also wanting to keep the retention numbers? How do you address those problems, those questions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great hypothetical, and it's certainly one that I think is very real. And so I think, you know, it applies equally to sort of increasing the diversity in our profession as well, because we see a lot of this too, where we have diverse attorneys who come into the profession and we don't necessarily support them in the ways that we need to. And what happens is we lose them. Right. And so I think the same is true here, is we have to find ways to support that, you know, that single mom attorney. And the support may look different, right, than the other attorney. And so, And I think we also have to think about sort of how we value work, and, you know, do we just value billable hours? Maybe we don't. You know, maybe there's more than just billable hours and business. You know, maybe we value the diversity that people bring, the perspectives that they bring. Maybe we value the way that they manage a team, right, as leaders. And this is definitely become a huge problem as well, where there's, I've seen firms where they're not necessarily really looking at the management styles of their senior associates when they're looking at when they're making the partnership decisions. So in thinking about like the treatment of younger associates by senior associates, because that can be a huge problem, particularly when you get people, these associates, into management positions and they don't have any training whatsoever. And so,
lawyers don't do that.
And that's and that's another thing that we're working on, is like establishing some management training programs, because we hear, there's lots of stories of people who, you know, who get to the brink of suicide because of how they're being treated by their manager, who, you know, may not have had any training to be in that role, right? So, so I know I may not be directly answering the question, but I think there are different ways, and I have heard firms, different people talk about specific ways to deal with it. But I think it's partially thinking about the different contributions, the type of value, the type of evaluation, and again, you know, thinking beyond the billable hour, I think.
Absolutely. So I know we've got I think we have a hard stop here in about 5 minutes, but I did want to ask you, are there any particular recommendations that your committee makes for lawyers in terms of ways to take care of yourself, you know, manage your mental health issues if you have them? Anything in particular that you could share with us?
Yeah, sure. So I think if you look at the definition of well-being as the National Task Force wrote up in their report back in 2017, there are different buckets, right? There's sort of emotional, occupational, social, physical, intellectual, and spiritual. And so the idea is to sort of figure out how to fill those buckets. They're not always going to be completely full all at the same time, right? But being aware that those all contribute to our well-being. And so, you know, when you think about particularly COVID and the isolation that has happened due to COVID, you know, making sure that you continue some sort of, you know, social network and support and people who you can confide in and talk to. You know, making sure that you're taking care of your emotional and mental health needs, you know, whether that's if you have a challenge, like actually going to get professional help, right? So actually seeking out help, taking care of your physical needs. I would say probably the number one thing there is sleep. I know a lot of attorneys who, exactly. And it's really important because it has serious effects on your ability to be an effective attorney, right? And then also the other one I was going to mention, I have just completely lost.
I know.
This is it. I got it. It came back. I wanted to just mention something about mindfulness and meditation, because it's one of these things that people sort of throw out there, and we sometimes say, oh, you know, these like yogis and people who do meditation, like they just kind of do their own little thing right over there. And I really believe that it should and can be mainstream. And because the idea behind mindfulness and meditation is just being in the presence. It's not something real crazy. It's just the ability to sort of ground yourself and be in this present moment. And by the way, it has like unbelievably studied benefits, right? You know, everything from like, you know, increasing your cognitive functioning, there's been studies about people who exercise more because of it. I mean, there's just like all this really great evidence. And so I just think it is something that people should test out.
The brain is like the iPhone, or at least my iPhone. I only use 25% of it. There's just so much more to people, you know.
Right.
There's a lot of apps
like
in there.
I like it.
All right. Well, I'm going to try more mindfulness. This has been great. I am fascinated by what you do, yeah, and the fact that, you know, 28 years into my practice and we're still having to talk about this stuff, like some of it is new, is still shocking to me to some extent. And literally I could talk to you for hours about diversity and well-being and all of it. So we were
so
super excited
that you agreed. Yeah, we
that
really
you agreed.
It.
Yeah, to come on the podcast. And we will endeavor in our practice to continue having regular yoga sessions with our lawyers, which we do in our yoga room in our firm.
And be kind and pay it forward and all.
Try
that
and pay
stuff.
Attention yeah. to yeah the stuff that really yeah. matters, and particularly right now in COVID. So we really super appreciate you and you being here and what you're doing, and we're gonna maybe find a way to have to bring you back another time. Maybe after the pandemic we could get you down here in person. Come on down to the South for a little trip.
That sounds great. And let me just say, I sort of right back at you, I appreciate that you're doing this, because this is how we continue to create awareness around these issues. So it's so important. So thank you so much for having me here.
You're
and
awesome.
Talking about
yes.
these important issues.
Yeah. Thank you. It was all great right. to meet you. Have a great afternoon.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye. Yeah. And for the Verdict folks, if you please just download, subscribe, listen, rate us,
go to the website,
visit our website. And if you have any special requests, send us an email at tryingtowin@linkinder.com.